Mr. Rogers, how are you?
Matthew Boyle, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. It's after the sun is shining and the English cricket team is flowing.
Is the English cricket team doing well? I know nothing of cricket. Go on. Do woo me with these terribly anglophilic words of cricket.
Well, we bowled the Australians out in Nottingham for 60 in their first innings. And they are now still about 90 runs behind with only 3 wickets remaining in their third innings. So,
Can I explain something to you that might be helpful here?
You know nothing about it.
No, I want to go further than that. I want to explain to you that there are only something like 0.5% of people in Scotland that know anything about it. And they play in the Scottish national cricket team. So
they got a good cricket team. It's an up-and-coming cricket team.
But there are people, you know, myself included, who are always happy to hear a sports story. So for future reference, Steve, there was one bit there I could make sense of, and that was they are 90 runs behind. See, if you just went straight for that, we are 90 runs ahead at the moment. I would have followed that. But see the thing about innings and stuff?
Yeah,
that's been technical.
Hey, what about the Tour de France then, while we're on the sporting thing?
I thought you were going to start explaining innings to us then.
I'm going to give up on that one. I just thought we'd go on to safely mutual ground here.
Do you know, I haven't even said welcome to each and every dog
yes.
podcast.
Episode five,
for goodness sake. Anyway, back to the Tour de France question. Very interesting. Yeah, a good tour this year.
Excellent.
I didn't watch any of it, but I followed it on the news every day and just read the reports of the stages. Quite a controversial one, I suppose, but very pleased that Chris Froome has done it.
Absolutely. I mean, I watched all the highlights. I was just gripped by it. And, you know, you got to feel sorry for the guy. What I found interesting outside of the sporting arena is how people are, you know, are taken to become sort of, you know, quotes, national treasures, you know, like how come, you know, Sir Bradley Wiggins becomes a sort of national folk hero. And Chris Froome, who's won now 2 Tour de France's and has done an incredible ride, is still sort of like, people are not quite sure. It's interesting, isn't it, how that...
It's totally fascinating. You know, what is the quality that makes you British? Because actually, it's not birth, because the British people have fairly adopted Bradley Wiggins. You know, he's our cool English lord, you know, but he's not born in England. He's not born in the UK. Is he not African-born or Dutch-born or something?
I'm not sure where, but
he's not in the classic mould, you know. But somehow there is something about him that the public find more British.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Certainly, Chris Froome is an interesting example because he could be argued not to be classic British in that he doesn't live here much of his time.
No,
and hasn't really, I think, other than brief periods in his racing career.
Yeah,
so, yeah. I don't know what it is. If there's one thing that the very all-embracing, multicultural British way of life allows us to do, it's to take anyone's victory they want attributed to us.
Even Andy Murray.
Even Andy. Hey, hands off, Andy.
Yeah.
Did I read this morning on the train that Andy Murray is now an expectant father?
Indeed, yep.
Well, I'm sure the Each and Every Dog podcast will... Well, I mean, we might wish to wish him well, but that just means we're wishing him sleepless nights. But actually, we might wish that it brings him a sanguine air that makes better tennis.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely.
Or,
yeah,
or yeah. am I missing the spirit of this somehow?
No.
That yeah. must be because I've got a 3.5-year-old. It's all still too recent for me just to say, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So I think we've done sport, haven't we?
Yes, yeah.
There's nothing else we've missed. There is actually a European athletics thing going on just now, but I don't know much about what's happening. I noticed the swimming as well. I think the British and Scots swimmers are doing well.
Doing very well, yeah, indeed.
World record, I believe, has fallen for relay.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't remember what stroke, whether it's freestyle or...
Was it the 4x100 freestyle, I think? But anyway, the guy won two golds in the breaststroke, didn't he? So
it's been a good one, because actually the 2012 Olympics, we had a bit of a... Disappointing isn't right, but you know, there was maybe a little more hope for the swimmers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe there's a next generation beginning to come through and maybe I'll peak for Rio.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. As ever, do you want the sports news? You come to each and every dog.
Yes.
The learning podcast.
The learning podcast. Yeah.
Well, can I tell you what I did today before you tell me what you've been doing since we last spoke? Incidentally, for any new listeners, this is our after a summer break catch up, isn't it? So
yeah, this is we've had a bit of a chilled out break with the sun has been shining on us and we've had our sun hats out and out on the terraces with our glass of wine, so it's not been full on, has it?
No, definitely not. Well, I had a terribly nice day, and if I'm going to be very British about this, it was terribly, terribly, terribly edifying and rewarding. If I was going to be very American about it, I would say I had an awesome day today. I was at a policy lab today on education. And I was in the company of one David Cameron and one Bill Boyd.
The real David Cameron,
yep. One Bill Boyd.
Oh,
one excellent. Laurie O'Donnell.
Wow.
I'm sure there are many others, but these are the... I'm trying to think if there are other inside learning worthies. There's a think tank in Scotland at the moment which has come very directly from the... I believe reasonably directly anyway, from the referendum period here. And they're very interesting. They're called the Commonweal. Do you recall we reviewed one of their papers?
Yes, yep.
Commonweal Education, a paper written by Professor Brian Boyd, who was once a guest on our cast, I think, a long time ago.
A long time, yep.
Well, the think tank was, I think it was part of, what were they called? I can't remember his name now. Jimmy such and such foundation, a left-leaning think tank.
Was it Jimmy? Not Reid.
It was Jimmy Reid. The Jimmy Reid Foundation. Good man.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, recently they've broken away and just become an independent think tank. And they're political in that they lobby. So they actually have a lobbyist and some full-time staff, all self-funded. So, basically it's donors from the, that are users and patrons of the think tank who fund it. And they have 7 or 8, I think, or 8 or 9, I heard, employees, including the lovely young woman who chaired today's proceedings, Katie Galloly-Swan. And they exist to develop policy on the Commonwealth. I think Commonweal means sharing of the wealth. I don't know where it comes from, which language. But basically they have this philosophy, they're not party political, but they are political. So they're trying to pull together a set of coherent policies to lobby politicians in Scotland with. Not to have power themselves, they're not interested, as far as I can see, in running for office. But they want to be a do tank, I think is the phrase they use. They want to, that's been used before, the Sutton Trust of that kind of idea as well. But I think they're doing a pretty good job at the moment of growing rapidly and capturing some sort of a groundswell, a popular mood at the moment. So I was invited to this one today on education, and I had just the best day. It was just lovely.
It was fabulous.
And the big questions we considered were, what would be the actions required to take education to where we believe it needs to be to match all of the other Commonweal policies? Now, I don't mean Commonweal as in, that they run anything politically, but they've got a coherent set of ideas that are based largely on Nordic countries.
Right.
The kind of, relatively egalitarian approaches that they have, and they use a lot of thinkers and academics, but this is one of their first goes, apparently, at trying to bring a wider set of people together to, you know, including academics, but also including professional educators. And indeed, we had two young learners as well, you know, from schools, and just a good number of people, probably about 25 to 30. And we split into four groups to consider big issues. And, you know, for example, we talked for much of the day around whether curriculum for excellence in Scotland is actually understood anymore. You know, have we lost what it meant? Should it be replaced with something? Or is it time for us to suggest that you know, serious policy deliverers might start to consider a strategy to revisit those values and to, you know, to maybe... identify actions that would help us to fully implement it, because there was a consensus that, you know, something's gone wrong. You know, we've got a good idea and there's a lot of buy-in to it, but somehow it's not being delivered. And there are a number of other areas around equalities, you know, and how we can address that in Scottish education, and around the exam system. You'll have picked up that we've
had
a bit of a national brouhaha, I believe Tom Lehrer would have called it in Scotland, over the fact that suddenly the maths exam, which was too hard, was standardised to give the same amount of passes as ever, on a pass rate, I believe, of something like 32%, 33%, 34%, something like that. But simultaneously, our national English higher exam just happened to pop up 15% over the piece nationally, as did our modern languages exams. It just happened to be 15, actually it was 17 for English, 15% better. There is a sense here that we're in some sort of an examination twilight zone. We're not quite sure, you know, how can you take any of this seriously anymore? So that was considered a bit, particularly in terms of how the high stakes final exams, which don't really seem to most of us to reflect the values that we originally identified for the curriculum for excellence. You know, how can we make sure they don't drive the system, and make sure that, you know, that teachers who we would wish to think about a holistic curriculum based around CFE, which was, of course, originally based around some version of the Treasure Within, you know, is realised. And, you know, we're not there yet. So just to finish and shut up, a marvellous day, some really great points coming out of it, some great buzz from the people that were involved, and a real commitment to, you know, to try and help take that policy advice forward. So yeah, you would have loved it, Steve.
That sounds really exciting. I suppose one of the issues you got is that, you know, curriculum for excellence really in a policy narrative term is still quite young, isn't it? I mean, it's...
10 years since it was first...
But that is a young... To my mind, that's still very young. I mean, that's infancy, isn't it, in terms of policy trajectory.
I don't know, when you say a thing like that is young Matthew, I kind of see you with a lightsaber at your side there, like kind of a Yoda hood on, you know. I admire your patience, you know, you see the universe in very wide and long terms, Master.
Yeah, well, politicians don't, do they? I mean, that's part of the problem we have, I think.
That was considered today as well. There was a sense.
Yeah, I mean, we're really stuck there with the exam. I mean, what do you do with the exam thing? I know you did a blog about it. You know, kind of what number do you want, boss? I mean, the problem is if you you know, if you have a criterion reference exam system, so that you kind of say, right, you know, these are the answers, these are the marks we're going to give. You know, and if kind of 80% of the population find it difficult, well, then tough, you know, we just have to mark it like that. So a criteria, then you're at the mercy of having kind of, how do you standardize between one year and the next, you know, because you could like this, your maths exam, they say, oh yeah, it was a bit hard this year. So, you know, you get a kind of, you get a high failure rate because actually the exams are not comparable from year to year. And that's the problem you have with a criterion reference exam system. You know, whereas if you set a norm reference exam system, then you say, oh, you get a hard exam, so we'll lower the pass mark, you know. So, but then you can, like, as you said, you can, in your what number do you want, boss, you know, you're in danger of being able to tweak the figures to suit the politicians. So you're really between a rock and a hard place, aren't you, with exam marking? I don't know what the answer is here.
Well, that was a major feature of today's conversations. Obviously, you know, you segued beautifully into a review of June and July's posts, largely June's because we haven't done any much in July. This. Yeah. But that arose from the pre-exam results admission that there was going to be standardisation, because there was a bit of a national social media outcry in Scotland, and many young people were saying this was a hellish exam, and we were demoralised and we came out in a poor state. Almost immediately after that, SQA, the Scottish Qualifications Authority, did announce we will standardise this. You know, they always avoid that language, but you and I both know what it means. You know, they would make the pass mark lower to make sure. And this is the difficult bit that we discussed today in the wake of the exam results, which is essentially that they'll make sure that a roughly similar amount of people pass the exam this year as did last year. So regardless of the exam, what we're saying is, despite all of the desire we have to address inequalities nationally and to make sure that that we're bootstrapping the whole system up, like the Nordic countries have tended to do, where the floor comes up, it's not a zero-sum game where the top lose and the previous losers start to gain. But actually, what we've done here is baked in exactly that kind of iniquity that, the same amount of people, regardless of what they did, above this point, should pass.
Yeah.
So the discussion today was actually moving on to saying, is that the right way to go anyway? Do we need an annual exam? Should it be annual? Why is it that anyone who didn't do well in this system now has to be, looking for political recourse? And we have had questions in the Scottish Parliament now about, what went on. Or should they be able to just go online and sit the exam again in a few months if they feel ready? Now, the latter is not possible because there is no online exam for the Scottish Qualification Authority, national exams. If you fail your higher maths, that's it. Feel free to take it again in 1 year's time. How demoralising is that for an individual human being?
That's right. Well, I mean, it just struck me listening to the debate, the bits I've listened to read in the press was, I mean, you're kind of caught between in a historical, you're in a historical cul-de-sac in one sense, because the schools are traditionally one purpose of the schooling is to sort people out, isn't it? So you're always going to norm reference your final exams because you don't want 90% of your young people capable of going to university because you just couldn't cope with it. You need the people who are going to kind of empty the bins, and in a sense, that's what traditionally, historically, education's been about. It's been a kind of sorting process for the market. Yeah. But curriculum for excellence actually says, hang on, education's a much richer process than that. We want something different out of our. And it seems to me that you've not kind of your assessment examination system has not caught up with the spirit of the purposes that you're reconsidering in curriculum for excellence. I mean, whereas in England, I think in England it kind of unashamedly says, well, actually, I don't care what the curriculum is. We're the kind of tradition of schooling is this, and sod it. We'll quite happily fail 20% because that's what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah, although you don't have that uniformity in England anyway, do you? You've got some schools that would buck that kind of thinking and be far more progressive anyway.
Or
do you sense there's a uniformity being imposed from the top now?
I think there's more of a uniformity being imposed from the top. I think there was a time when, particularly when, there was a drive to sort of have more numbers in higher education. So, there was a Labour Party target back in, 97, after the 97 election to say, well, we want more than 50% of young people to go to university.
Yeah.
Schools were judged on the kind of number of exams passes. You got some quite creative uses of the exam system, So, for example, schools kind of manufacturing all these. There was a school, I believe, in Telford, has kind of created their own IT diploma thing, which was worth you know, three GCSEs or whatever. I haven't got the exact details, but you know what I mean. There was a kind of entrepreneurship around the kind of curriculum, around the qualifications aspect. So schools were inventing all these kind of qualifications that would count for X number of points in, you know, and children, young people could pass these things, and therefore the school would be kind of get a better tick on the Ofsted box, but also that would enable more kids to go to university. But I think what the coalition government under Gove, and certainly, you know, has carried on in that way, is saying, hang on, we need to revert to a more traditional system. We're going to make the exams, you know, we think GCSEs will actually, the old O levels were more of a standard. You know, we want to kind of a more standardized playing field, and the exam sort of system is going to get tougher for people. You know, you can't kind of game your way around it. Now, you can see there's some merit in the argument. You know, you know, schools shouldn't be able to game their way around systems. But on the other hand, you'll go back to a kind of system where, you know, schools that are good at producing those exam results will do better by their kids. I mean, there's winners and losers, whatever way you play it.
Yeah, we got really into the debate today about, you know, whether you should trust teachers to do more internal assessment or whether it had to be a tough external, you know. But in the end, there was a view emerged that, well, you know, that doesn't matter. That's a red herring. The point is that actually they're too high stakes. You know, it's life and death virtually for some of these young people.
Yeah.
You know, what they get in terms of their hires, their, you know, national fives, their GCSEs, their A-levels. You know, these are big, you know, trying to avoid saying things like wrist slitting, you know, but they're depression inducing, you know, levels of stress for people. But what if it was more trivial? You know, that actually they weren't annual. You just took them when you were ready, and you took the reset when you were ready. Equally well that the big exam agencies, you know, kind of were smaller players. You know, that yes, they were a part of it, but the whole school wasn't predicated around the idea that it would be 10 to 16. Big, you know, life or death tests at the end of the year, but instead you might be using some external agencies from various walks of life, or commerce or accountancy or computing or science, who had their own little online tests that, you know, youngsters could take. Because the big thing again that came out of today's conversation was, what's it all for? At the end of the day, employers or businesses that want to hire young people, or, you know, I mean, that's why you would need a qualification, I suppose, or universities, they know what they're looking for anyway. And how well do our exams actually serve as a proxy for what an institution or a company wants?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I mean, it's interesting because I heard of a neighbour of ours whose son is going through the whole process and has got, wanted to do architecture at university, and it was kind of given really hard high grades, you know, like A's and B's in order to get places at A, you know. But he's apparently he's done like various projects and he's blogged about it, you know, and this one university said, oh, we'll give you an unconditional offer. You know, as long as you pass your A-levels.
That's great. Interesting.
You know, because they've obviously, I mean, I don't know the details of it, but they've obviously seen something in what he's been doing independently and in his project work that they think, yeah, actually this guy's got something and we'll offer him a place. Yes.
And yet I suppose he's still got to get the qualifications behind that, but to what extent do they really tell you something? You know, it's really interesting. I'm not belittling them. They tell you something, but should they tell you everything? You know,
like, yeah, absolutely not.
Architecture, you know, you need 3 A-levels or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Well, what if you have 1 A-level and 2 near misses, but, a history of blogging for 3 or 4 years in architecture yourself, some of your own original designs that they absolutely love.
Absolutely.
There's just a lack of sophistication in how
absolutely.
We prepare young people.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I suppose we should put that one to bed anyway. You segue beautifully into the blog post from the 6th of June what number do you want, boss? I was quite cross at that time, so I kind of got that out there. I do think I think it was my friend Jerry who I was talking to who came up with that phrase. He said, "Yeah, I was, you know, I'm an ex-maths teacher looking at that and thinking, you know, that's exactly the dialogue that happens in the corridors of power in in Edinburgh at the moment. You know, well, you know, what number do you want the pass mark to be at now? I'm sure the statisticians do it, but it resulted in some of my colleagues back in my education authority when we've been looking at the results in the last week or so, saying, you know, in response to the fact that nationally we're reporting that across the board we've had a 5% improvement in performance. Well done to our young people.
Yeah.
Well, this colleague of mine, who I won't name, said wryly, "Yep, the statisticians played a blinder."
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, and there's very good evidence that at one time there were exam boards going around schools selling their wares, saying, "Oh, well, ours, you know, you'll get ours are a little bit easier than Joe Bloggs down the road. You know, you'll get more. You'll get more."
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Which, to be fair, to go, you know, I know we've had our moments with Gove et al. And but Gove said, "Well, if you want an exam system, you know, it's got to be rigorous and standardized." You know, I think what you and I are saying is actually the exam system, yeah, okay, if it's got to be fair for everyone, but actually it's such a crude measure, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a blunt instrument, as someone said today. Yeah. Okay, where will we go next?
Well,
back over the posts. Before we get, actually, because you had a couple in a row that were about the philosophical number, can I come quickly to fail faster?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was the next one chronologically anyway.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at this for a long time, so listeners will hopefully forgive me if I'm a bit vague on it myself, being as it's my post. But once again, the utterly wonderful Freakonomics podcast inspired me. I am loving it. They've had a bit of a summer break as well, and they've been doing lots of repeats and stuff to keep it going, so I haven't had the same level of recent inspiration, but I cannot overemphasize to people what a great podcast that is. Have you listened to it yet?
No, I must admit, actually, I'm sorry. I know you keep inspiring. I promise.
It's all right. Hey, it took me, 6 months or something to actually do the Hole in the Wall podcast that you and Jay used to rave about on the podcast.
Yeah.
Not the podcast, the TED Talk.
Yeah, right.
Sagata Mitra. So, yeah, you got plenty of time. you're still more diligent than I am. Anyway, this post, Fail Faster, it was the wonderful Stephen Levitt on the Freakonomics podcast, who's the author of the Freakonomics book, along with, Levitt and... I actually haven't read the book, because I can't find it on audio either. Oh, what's it? Levitt and... It'll come to me. Anyway, yeah. Levitt's a co-author of Freakonomics, and they sometimes appear together in the podcast. But what they were talking about was the really interesting situation whereby there was a story shared as a prompt for some economist, whereby in a business that was opening a shop in China.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll remember more than me if you read this recently. There was a new store, there was sort of an inventory, a supply chain, you know, there were local business requirements, all these things that needed to be in place for it to open on time. And the big boss basically said to the team, "Is this going to be ready in time? Is this store opening?" And everyone in turn basically said, yes, challenges, but yes, boss, it will happen. And actually, there was, by coincidence, which makes the story interesting, an internal sweepstake in the organisation, with people saying, "Will it open in time or not?" And
will
the long and short of it is, people privately, and that's the point of it, in their sweepstake, where there was no high stakes, you could say what you really thought, predicted correctly that the store would not open in time. Whereas whenever the boss asked anyone, you know, it was, "Well, with reservations, we've got these difficulties," but you had to say, "But we're going to overcome them, boss. It'll be fine."
Yeah.
And it didn't. And of course, it then goes on to talk about the much darker story, one which has moved me as a science fan, and, you know, a lifelong science fan, although obviously a wee bit out of touch with it now. That sad, sad story of Challenger and the, you know, the disaster in the space shuttle. I don't know if you ever saw the documentaries that there were on it. There was certainly a very good one the BBC had at the time on Panorama or something like that. And they spoke to one of the senior managers who worked for Thiokon, who made the solid rocket boosters. Listeners who are not technical or don't know the story might be unaware that what happened was that in the Challenger disaster with the 7 dead astronauts, including one teacher, whose name probably would come to me actually, what was her name? Krista McAuliffe. That basically there are rubber sealing rings that attach these two solid rockets. I mean, they're basically, you know, rockets like fireworks, except on an enormous scale. Once they're ignited, you don't turn them off. Those boys are going up one way or another. And these rubber seals weren't tested at very low temperatures. And there had been a few photographs taken of previous shuttles when there were, you know, flames coming from the seals occasionally, just spurts. Enough to make the Thiokon engineers start to investigate the performance of this rubber sealing material at low temperature. Clearly, you know, these rockets are not supposed to be, you know, not supposed to be releasing any gases, you know, anywhere except from their designated exhaust ports, yeah. You know. And it's a really sad story because this guy, whose name, I'm sorry, is long gone, but I remember him talking very, very poignantly about, you know, trying to engage everyone at a time when NASA were saying this shuttle has to go. He's saying, but the temperatures are lower at launch this time than we've ever had, and we're worried about the temperature of these seals. I can't guarantee they'll be safe. And he was basically bulldozed, and his colleagues were bulldozed into... say it's safe for launch, say it's safe. And this one guy has now got the cold comfort of being able to say, I never did say that, I was just sidelined. But actually, the point of the whole thing then was, actually, failure's your friend. You know, failure isn't a bad thing. And if you could say earlier on in an organisation, look, this isn't working, we haven't managed this, whatever way, it would be okay. You know, it would be good for an organisation if you could do that, you know. And actually, I had an experience, I think I spoke to you about in a previous podcast, when you know, there's an initiative I had done professionally, or I'd been involved in, I didn't set it up, but it wasn't working. And it was great in the wake of listening to one of the Freakonomics podcasts on failure, to be able to say, guys, I think we haven't done this well. We haven't succeeded. And you know what? That's great. Let's get around the table now and talk further about how much more this is going to fail.
Yeah.
You know? But actually, the post here was saying there was something else going on here, which was about our fear of failure. You know, why is it that people said to the bosses, sorry, I've sidelined a bit there, but to come back to this story, why is it people can't just go to the boss and say, look, it's not going well, this isn't good, we need to go back to the drawing board? No, it's because people are scared of their bosses, the hierarchies are difficult, and the bosses don't want to go and report failure, so they'd rather pressurise people into success. But take that back to schools. So one of the messages they're saying, and the Freakonomics team have said over a long time, isn't it a good thing if you fail quickly? The education might not be just about saying, look, these are the 8 or 10 or whatever core experiences you've got to have until you're 18. Why don't we let you try lots of things, you know? And it's probably reasonable to make you try them for a while. But supposing you reached, you know, 14 years old and you're saying, maths is not for me. I'm failing at it. I'm doing really badly. I hate it. I'm my morale is low. Why do I have to do any more? I'm basically numerate. That's as much as I've managed. And that was the point of this post. Actually, yeah. We don't allow that, do we?
No.
We won't accept that failure. So in our horror of having kids fail at anything, we force them to continue to fail. So the title Fail Faster was just a simple plea to say, maybe in school, part of our mission should be to let young people experience a lot of things, so that they can succeed at some things and enjoy them and become great. As Ken Robinson would say, and I think I mentioned that in there, find your element, you know, become wonderful at certain things. But be allowed to not waste your time becoming miserable at what you don't do well, but to fail faster.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if it's not just fear of... I think there's something else going on here, not just fear of telling your boss, hang on, this is wrong, or, you know, we don't think it's going to work. I wonder if there's something now in the contemporary psyche that says, actually, we're in control of stuff. You know, we have this kind of rational approach, to managers, you know, the whole kind of notion of leadership in education. Yeah, you can train leaders. We need high quality leaders. Ergo, they're always people who are in control.
Yeah.
So actually, it's not. It's about kind of not admitting that we can't control it. You know that actually human life, a lot of human life is unpredictable, or we can't control certain things in life. But actually, as a leader, you can't be seen to say that. So you have to have an encourage. You know, you have to have a culture in which everything's under control.
Yeah.
And oh, I'm going to come round and inspect your work tomorrow, Matthew, because I think I can control you. You know, you can control you. You can do better. I'm going to come in and make sure you can do it. Because we have this kind of, we have this sort of myth that actually, if we would just be reasonable and rational and set a few targets, you know, it's all under control. So I don't necessarily think it's about fear of the bosses. I think that there's something about our contemporary rationality that says we're in control. There's always a technical solution.
Which is amazing, because the literature at the moment about leadership and management quite clearly says that what almost every serious company CEO is learning internationally is that their biggest inability now is to control.
Yeah.
You know, they may think they're setting directions and pulling levers, but they don't seem to do the things that they say on the labels anymore.
No. Yeah.
I think that's fascinating. Anyway, so...
I think it's... and actually, if you followed through your... what you've learned from Freakonomics, I mean, it would have fundamental implications for the way we organise schools.
Yeah.
Absolutely fundamental implications.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting.
Well, that's Fail Faster from the 9th of June. It's up there on eachandeverydog.net. So if anyone fancies a wee look at that, it's there. Steve, something really great happened, particularly in the month of June. And I'm going to take entire credit for it.
Please do. Whatever it was.
You started a series of writing that I've long urged you to do. It's the Fred Learns Philosophy series for Each and Every Dog listeners.
Right.
Obviously, my description doesn't resonate with you.
No. You said, why don't you draw on your interest in philosophy to write?
Well, you're passionate about philosophy. That's just your thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're saying that as though you're a man who isn't passionate about philosophy.
No, I am. No. I just think the thing about philosophy is it. The more you think about it, the less the fewer answers you have, the more questions you raise. But there you go.
Well, I think that's arguably true of any sociological constructs, including education. You know, that was the challenge I had today. All these people together, pretty much having to admit we didn't have easy answers. However, yeah. You know, you produced a series of things today. Last month, Tail Wags Dog, Philosophical Dog Bites Back, The Aristotelian Dog. The one that I found the most challenging but interesting read, The Pooch Reads Rawls. Your poor hound has been dragged in as a proxy here, yeah.
Yeah.
So could you talk us through what you were trying to do through the month and some of the highlights in these three posts, which I mean, I'll just be up front for readers and say, actually, I found them quite hard reads.
Did you find them hard reads?
All of them, but I read them all three times at least.
Okay.
Because I've wanted this. This is a thing that's a weakness of mine. You know, the amount of information philosophers I've read personally would basically cover a postage stamp. I think the only person I've actually read like a chapter or two on was Hume.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember why. I think it was as a pretentious teenager just trying to figure out what the Scottish philosopher was about.
Good Scottish Enlightenment philosopher there. So why not?
Nothing. And I really am excited about this. I could see, a whole series of these and a book even on it, Because it's so hard to access the works of a philosopher and try and get a sense of what they're about. And I think you've begun to try and do that here. It's lovely.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, I think, is go back to the original and think about... I mean, the starting point was when we started this off, Inside Learning was kind of very much... We felt was very much focused around the news and policy, what was happening in schools, but we were thinking, hang on, this is a very narrow section of our lives, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a very narrow take on what learning and what we believe learning and education is about. So we wanted to And I did kind of float this notion of in each and every dog that we've been more eclectic. But I thought, hang on, we never really defined what that eclectic, what we mean by eclecticism. So my starting point was actually when we talk about learning was, well, we could talk about it from a number of points of view. We could talk about the neuroscience, you know, what happens in the brain, the cognitive, because people are doing more about cognition. We could talk about pedagogy because there's some fantastic teachers out there, and we have fantastic teachers on the, you know, and people like Anne Glennie who are kind of pedagogues, aren't they? And, you know, will tell us about pedagogy.
Absolutely.
We could look at it from, so, you know, we've got that side. We could look at it from kind of about stuff, you know, about what's knowledge, what does knowledge mean? You know, what do we trust? We could look at it, we could look at the cultural kind of aspects of learning, you know, and how does it intersect with notions of your class, you know, your background, race, gender, sexuality, all these things kind of play into it. So actually the whole kind of, when we talk about learning, we're talking about a whole range of motivations, structures, and processes going on. But actually, at the end, at the heart of it, so I thought, well, actually, what kind of, at the heart of it, for me, is at the heart of it, there's something about creativity and excitement. You know, why does it excite you? And I guess it came back to a really ancient sort of philosophy, which is kind of Aristotle, you know, who's looking at the, who said, well, what, you know, what's the kind of purpose of a human life?
Oh, Steve, I mean, I have to come in here. That was a great post. This is the Aristotelian dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing about the good life.
Yeah.
I don't have the right phrase, I don't have the post open, but something like that. Was it the good life?
Yeah.
I thought it was a fascinating, you know, given that you're talking 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that. Just get your head around that. 2,500 years ago. And we still have someone's ideas there, you know, which have a contemporary resonance.
Yeah. I mean,
how can that even be?
Yeah. I mean, there's huge amounts of Aristotle that we just can't accept in the modern world, obviously, no. You know, and ancient Greece is a very different society. But there's something here about, you know,
talent and fulfillment and place in society,
yeah,
and what it means to be, you know, to be good, to be, you know, of worth to your society.
And
to
meaning.
To feel fulfilled and find meaning, yeah. And it's not taking reference to religions or anything like that. It was a very societal answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other thing about the ancients, which...
You really should say something about that now. Sorry, Steve, that's not fair.
Yeah.
Because any listeners who have not read the piece will be thinking, what does that mean? What was this good life?
Yeah, I mean, Aristotle starts, I mean, in his book, I mean, Aristotle, there's no kind of books of Aristotle. There are lecture notes which have been collected. I mean, there is a kind of famous story that when he kind of fled Athens, you know, he was a pupil of Plato. He set up his own academy.
But they only had
a platonic
relationship.
Of his... Yeah. He kind of left Athens in a hurry because I think is he Macedonian, I think Aristotle by birth, but there was some kind of, you know, anti kind of Macedonian feeling.
Like Alexander the Great?
Yeah, he was. Well, he was a tutor to Alexander the Great. I mean, he tutored Alexander the Great. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So,
I've read a little about Alexander.
But he tutored that. So there was a kind of wave of anti-Macedonia. Presumably there was some sort of Nigel Farage in Athens who was saying we don't like Macedonians. So, but he left. I mean, the story goes that he left Athens in a hurry, and his lecture notes were found in a ditch. Now, obviously, that I don't know how true that is, but essentially, there's. The works we have of Aristotle have been collected into books. I mean, I'm not a huge expert. I've read the Nicomachean Ethics and his Politics. And I mean, but he says what human beings begin to do philosophy even as they do now because of wonder. You know, because we wonder about the strange things right in front of us. You know, so we puzzle about them, and that's our starting point. And for Aristotle, everything in nature has some sort of its telos or final purpose. You know, so crudely speaking, you know, the purpose of a flute is to make beautiful music. Stones fall to the ground because they belong to the earth and are striving to return there. But the final purpose or distinctly characteristically human activity is to achieve what he called eudaimonia. Now, some people translate that as happiness, but it's not apparently sufficient. You know, it's more about well-being and flourishing. It's to achieve a flourishing life. And to do that, you need to live virtuously. You need a rational life. And actually learning, you know, when you and I talk about learning, it's about that sense of purpose, trying to create something meaningful. And that's the kind of very much in the Aristotelian tradition. Plato is very much a sort of a rationalist. Aristotle was very much a kind of hands-on, you know, let's get dirty guy, you know, and go out and smell the flowers and classify them. And, you know, Plato was very much into his maths, and he thought the kind of, you know, the whole notion of truth that is kind of beyond our knowing is a kind of Platonic thing. This kind of whole, you know, Plato has a huge influence on Western philosophy, but Aristotle's very much a kind of empirical sort of guy. You know, actually the only way to live virtuously is to go out and try and do it. You know, and yeah, life and there's some kind of parallels between Aristotle and current self-help sort of philosophy, you know, the self, but unlike the kind of American self-help, yeah, we can do whatever you can be whatever you can be. I think the classical Greeks would kind of say, well, actually life is a bit shit, it's difficult, and sometimes the fates are against you, you know, the gods are against you, but actually you've just got to make the best of it, and you have to try and do what you can to struggle through it. And I think that's a huge lesson still to learn, that you know, there's so much that we don't know. There is kind of an evil part of human nature, you know, and we're seeing that played out in so many areas of the world at the moment. So you've got to kind of struggle to be on the one hand wise in a practical sense, but also to enjoy the, you know, the theoretical wisdom we call Sophia, the kind of contemplative life, which is what we're doing now, you know, that kind of thinking and reflecting about life, which is what this kind of podcast is about.
Well, wonderful stuff. And a couple of questions, I suppose, that listeners themselves might share. First, a personal one, eudaimonia, which I didn't really know how to pronounce. It resonated in terms of what do you call the taxonomy about the human condition, you know, self-actualization. Whose is that one? Mm. It's not Bloom's, it's the other big taxonomy.
I mean that was in Bloom's, wasn't it? But
Maslow's hierarchy, sorry. Mm. Yeah, is it somehow similar?
Yeah, there are many things that if you look at social psychology, a lot of social psychology, you see many things in social psychology which you could relate to Aristotle. I think particularly the notion of habits, you know, because I mean Aristotle was saying that it's not something that we're born with necessarily, but we acquire them, you know, through habit, through doing. You know, it's like you can't be born a good educational leader, and you can't necessarily train a good educational leader. You have to become a good educational leader by doing good educational leadership. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And for that, and this is why I think all the current debates about coaching and modeling and having that apprenticeship are actually kind of very Aristotelian. That's what, you know, Aristotle would have said. Yeah, you know, you've got to learn the kind of virtues of courage, prudence, justice, by being with people who are, you know, your elders and betters in a sense. He felt very much that the young weren't going to kind of grasp this unless they were kind of allied to the right people.
Well, the second question, I suppose, that I was coming around to, not the personal one, more the generic one. What would you say, Steve, to people that are a little bit skeptical about philosophy that feel as if it, you know, exists in some sort of an ethereal state, and, you know, doesn't particularly marry well with our, you know, practical problems and practical purposes. So you partially kind of addressed that, I think, with your assertion that Aristotle is not in that mould, that he is actually quite a practical theorist himself. But, you know, would you be able to mount a wider defence about the various philosophers that you consider?
Yeah, no, I think so. Obviously, you have to. I think every kind of philosopher has to be considered sociologically as well, because they're all, you know, he or she, or they're all part of a particular era. And it's difficult sometimes to take them out of context. But most of the arguments that we have today will have been thought of at some point by a philosopher. I mean, if you take, you know, the pre-kind of classical Greek philosopher like Democritus, you know, who, for example, said that, well, the world is composed of atoms, you know, had an idea about, you know, nuclear physics kind of 3,000 years before.
He wasn't into the, who was it that did the how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, or is this purely apocryphal?
No, it wasn't him. It was late. But I mean, it was, but. Yeah, but at some point, some branch of philosopher would have considered a key question that we face today. And I think, you know, yeah, I mean, some philosophers, you know, some philosophy is a bit up its own backside, and philosophers love thought experiments like the trolley problem, which are kind of, people think, oh God, how do you relate that to real life? But it's the kind of people's thoughts, but you know, you take a film such as The Matrix, for example.
A great favourite of mine, a film which didn't need The Matrix 2 or 3.
No, right. But I mean, there's philosophers who had those kind of thought experiments beforehand, you know, and presumably the film must have picked up on some of that philosophical thinking. I mean, the latest one was Robert Nozick, you know, a contemporary of John Rawls, who talked about the experience machine, because he said, well, would you, you know, if you had the kind of option of living in the Matrix, like, so for example, if you had a steak and the steak tasted good enough to you, but actually it was all a kind of virtual reality, I mean, you know, would you, if I offered you that possibility, you'd probably reject it, wouldn't you? You would say, well, hang on, Matthew, I'm going to put you in a vat, I'm going to plug you into some virtual reality, and when you go out to a restaurant and have a steak and you bite and you taste it, it's great. Why not accept it? But I mean, Robert Nozick's argument was actually most people probably wouldn't accept that kind of experience machine, and that was kind of one of the things in The Matrix.
It's fascinating, and a brilliant topic for two vegetarians to chew over.
I mentioned
on
steak
a podcast. Well, is that not because he did?
Yeah, I mean, I think ethically as well. I mean, when you look at all the, I mean, it's the 70th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing.
Oh yeah, how sad.
I met one of the survivors from Hiroshima. He came over to address a CND kind of rally, and we talked afterwards, you know. And yet, you know, there was a very utilitarian argument that actually we're going to cause some huge damage now in order to avoid great damage.
Yeah, yeah. And good people bought into that. Like,
absolutely.
You know, not just Oppenheimer, but, you know, my own beloved Richard Feynman and Einstein, you know, there were people who you wouldn't characterize as evil, bad men.
No, but that's a classical utilitarian argument. You know, you could trace that back to the kind of, you know, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, 18th century utilitarianism, and these things, the kind of these sort of questions, although not in that form, have been debated in philosophy, and yet nobody's thought about the wider kind of wisdom of that sort of technology. What do we do with that technology? You know, what about the ability to genetically modify our genes? What about, you know, our nanotechnology? You know, all these sort of issues need thinking about philosophically, because we can't just sort of launch them and say, well, we have the science, let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that simple, because the consequences are vast. You know, like, you know, you think about the consequences of that nuclear warhead and the Cold War and what we're living with now. We're revisiting the Cold War. You know, that's why I would argue that it needs a kind of philosophical debate.
Yeah, I agree. Well. Before we move off from this, you know, there's a richness of this stuff here. The Aristotelian thing was really in two parts, I think, wasn't it? Your tail wags dog, philosophical dog bites back, when you outlined that you would use Aristotle as a thread for your first three posts.
Yeah.
Your first few. Take us quickly through the Rawls one, which was the one, the Aristotelian dog, I found an easier read. The Pooch reads Rawls from memory. I don't have it open in front of me. I haven't looked at it for over a month. But from memory, it was about the underpinnings of justice.
Yeah, because...
But with reference to Aristotle as it went on.
Yeah, because... one of the key things about Aristotle, the notion of introducing the notion of virtue and desert into questions of justice. So, I mean, in the politics, Aristotle asks, you know, because he talks about justice as distribution, about who gets what goods in a society. So it's a kind of question of distribution. So he asks, you know, if you had one really top-notch flute, who should get that flute?
Flutes come up a lot in your...
Yeah, well, it's just one of the, I think it's the flute he uses. I mean, he uses a harp in the Nicomachean Ethics, but it's the flute in this example I've read in the Politics. And he said, well, it's actually the best flute player should get that flute, because what's the purpose of a flute? Well, the purpose of the flute is to make beautiful music. So the person who's best disposed to make that beautiful music is the best flute player. So what Aristotle brings in is to ask, what is the purposes of a practice? What's the purpose of a good? What's the kind of telos here that we're? What virtues does this honor? I mean, Rawls kind of rejected the notion of desert as a basis for social justice, because he said, actually, well, it's you know, that's a matter of luck. You know, if somebody's born with greater talent, that's just sort of luck. Rawls is one of the sort of, I suppose, he's one of the key thinkers of Western liberalism. I mean, all our political class who've done, you know, a lot of our political class who've read philosophy, politics, and economics, a lot of them at Oxbridge, would have read John Rawls. I mean, absolutely, you know, fundamentally. And he had a kind of complex, you know, I can't obviously summarize it here, the justice as fairness. But I mean, why I brought Aristotle into that is because in his, in his book on political liberalism, he was saying that a well-ordered society, it's like he called the Aristotelian principle. The better we get at ordering our society, the more we'd want to do it. And he drew on Aristotle because it's that notion of Aristotle saying, you know, finding meaning in purpose in our learning. So, for example, if you, like yourself, Matthew, you're interested in photography, so you have a passion for photography, so you don't want to be taking any old snap, you know, and being happy with it. You actually want to get better at it.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
And if you're a chess player, it's no good you turning up to a chess club and getting thrashed every time. You know, you want to, so you start reading all the opening moves and saying, yeah, this is a Sicilian defense and I do this. So the Aristotelian principle is that actually, if we start to learn and get passionate about something, then humans automatically want to get better at it. They're not satisfied with kind of, you know, so you wouldn't be satisfied with just having your kind of taking a bit of a selfie and saying, no, I've got a snap. you want to get better and better and understand your photography more. And that's what Aristotle was saying about the kind of purpose of human flourishing. You know, that's what we do by nature. So John Rawls was sort of bringing that principle into the notions of justice and political liberalism, and saying actually the more well ordered and the more kind of politically liberal our society becomes, the more kind of we use justice as fairness, the more we want to do it better. He kicked off a huge sort of debate. I mean, there's been volumes and libraries of stuff that have written against him and for him. And I think what's interesting currently about Rawls, what I think is worth going back to is because if you take, for example, the current debate about terrorism and Islam, you know, fundamentalism, I'm not saying this is paranoid, but even say the argument for Scottish devolution.
Yeah.
There are certain arguments in our society where we're never, ever going to agree. We're just not going to agree. You know, I'm never going to convince a Christian or a Muslim to my humanist sort of viewpoint.
Yeah.
You know, there's just, you know, we can have a conversation about it, but Rawls was saying, well, actually, we've got to learn to live with that. You know, we've got to part that.
Yep.
What we've got to do is find political institutions that say which kind of have an overlapping consensus. The notion of law, your version of what a good life is and my version of what a good life is have to be parked. But where we meet is actually how do we arrange our lives so that you and I can live out our notion of the good life without harming each other.
My God, it's almost like Senge.
Go on.
Well, Senge's idea in business is that you and I might meet together and be thrown into the same team. And you might have some fundamentally different views from mine and different paradigms and filters. But actually, the only way that we can make sense of that is to figure out our mission together and to spend a lot of time talking, thinking and figuring. And alignment for him doesn't mean agreement. It means working out what are the things that we can do that let us get on with living successfully, effectively together within, you know, the business, the organisation that we're working in. So alignment isn't agreement. It's a searching for the common ground and common direction that we can begin to, you know, build bridges on and work well together with.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds very, you know. So
I mean, am I going too far in saying then that your analysis of what Rawls has said actually underpins the kind of contemporary use of Senge that a lot of our head teachers are using in schools?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I would imagine Senge actually is drawn on Rawls's thinking in the business field. I mean, Rawls
he might not have a clue about Rawls. He might not be as bright as you.
Oh, no,
and
no.
He might not have read each and every book.
I think Rawls is actually, you know, I think is fundamental to so much political thinking. I'd be very surprised if there's very few kind of intellectuals in the kind of the West who haven't heard or read Rawls. It's really interesting because it is actually his thinking doesn't filter into. I mean, all the time I've spent kind of with kind of people doing educational leadership, John Rawls is never mentioned. But he underpins so much of current liberalism, and in fact, in some ways, he's probably a bit too leftist for much of America, because one of his principles was the difference principle, you know, that we're going to have inequalities in society, but actually inequalities should be organized so that they benefit the least advantaged. So, you know, he would probably say, okay, if we've got private schools, you know, they may not be a good thing in terms of equality. But if you can demonstrate politically that they benefit the least advantaged, because those people who go to private school actually do a lot to lift people out of poverty, then fair enough. But I think he would challenge current thinking on educational structures, because he would say, well, look, you know, you've really got to demonstrate that the differences the inequalities in our society are actually working to the benefit of the least advantaged, and they're quite patently not. So
I liked that in your post. I must admit, it's been more than a month since I read it, but I like the logical underpinning to equality.
Yeah,
And I could see that you could take different tacks on it, but it was great to see that his was one of the major underpinning ones that we now use.
Yeah, but I think probably people have not kind of seen through the whole implications of his thinking. But I think, he confined his ethics, his kind of notion of justice to political arrangements. He's saying, right, it doesn't matter what goods you think should be in play. It doesn't matter what goods you think society should be aiming for. But at some point, yes, they'll inform how you live your life and they'll inform what you bring to the table. But at some point, we've got to create a political system that enables us to live together.
Yeah. Well, Steve, we've crossed the hour.
Wow.
I know, but we get into philosophy and we get into that kind of area. It's inevitable. It's been a long break, so let's not panic. Let's just try and bring the thing logically to completion, eh?
Yep.
Thank you for that. I suppose the obvious question for me is, where do you go next with this? It's been a fascinating series for me, and it's really broadened my thinking. I've really, really liked it, and I actually like being pushed by you in this. I want you to take me to new places.
Well, there's a poster we can talk about next time, which I've written about Martha Nussbaum's work. And she, because she disagrees with rules about, because rules has what we might call a thin conception of the good.
I believe you did, actually, in it.
When Martha Nussbaum said, well, actually, that's not sufficient. And I'm more with Martha Nussbaum on this than John Rawls, that actually, if we're talking about education and schooling, we need to have we need to be a bit more specific about what goods we want out of it.
Yeah.
We can't be as liberal as maybe John Rawls might want us to be. But, that's a whole nother argument.
Well, I look forward to that because, as I say, it's a good series. And I'm really genuinely excited that you started it. It was needed. I've worked with you on this fun project on and off for, 6-7 years?
Yeah.
More? I don't know. More?
Yeah.
And there's only every, there's barely a podcast that you don't mention a philosopher. So thank you on behalf of our listeners. It's great that you're doing this for us. I think we need to quickly thank Jay.
Yeah, because we have
James Hilbert. Yep. He did a piece on his visit to, Malta, was it? No, not Malta, Crete. He went on a visit to the rather snappily named EPNOSL, the European Policy Network for School Leadership.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is as part of his role as a fellow in the new Scottish College of Educational Leadership, which is an embryonic affair. It's not on the vast scale that the English College of Educational Leadership was, but he basically gives an account in this. I'm not going to try and summarise it, but a very, very full account, as Jay's posts often are, of the big issues that were discussed internationally in terms of school leadership. And it crossed over a little bit with school improvement as well, because many of the same same players were present at this conference, and he was hugely influenced by it. Looked at the kind of trends in terms of what schools are supposed to deliver and produce, over the last 50 years, how the seduction of the PISA ratings, which you've often counseled caution on yourself, have influenced, and about the sort of basics around system leadership, teacher leadership, what these things mean. I have to say that none of it seemed like new information. These are debates that are long-standing, but he gives a really good summary of what happened at this year's EPNOSL conference.
Yeah, it was a very good summary, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the question of who leads and who follows. We'll have to get Jay back on, I think, to...
Yeah, to say more about this. Just to say, if you're interested in school leadership and the international perspective, or if you're interested in the development of scale in Scotland, then, you know, all of these would be... Or if you just love Jay. These are all good reasons to pop on to Each and Every Dog and have a look at his post from the 17th of June.
And you've got... I mean, I've talked a lot this evening, but there's two kind of... blogs that you've written, which we've not touched upon. So
these were responses, Steve, to our ongoing desire to try and make this an eclectic blog.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we've really defined that yet, but one of the things that, in concrete terms, it means for us is to move from schools.
Yeah.
Because if you look at our blogs, which we could reblog and will, I think, occasionally from Inside Learning, which we did for years on and off. It means moving to the personal as well as, the school, the adult as well as the child, So one of them, was a blog which, interestingly, I wouldn't have made 2 years ago. I would have had the thought and the conversation and I would have walked away thoughtfully and never considered writing it. But actually, our mission now has made me do so. It's an interesting example of where your mission and your sense of what you want to achieve makes you frame things differently. I was coaching a colleague who had some difficult thoughts and choices to make about next steps in career. And in coaching, I don't know if you've done that stuff, Steve, but there are moments where you try and give a bit of yourself. Someone's opening up and saying, this is what I feel, this is what I think, and this is why I've got a dilemma. And after maybe 45 minutes of that, sometimes you can feel, this is very one way, and it's not about the coach should stay out of it. But there are points when you see someone saying repeatedly, but I feel a bit odd, and is this odd, sometimes it's nice to give a little bit yourself to get, the other person to feel the rapport again, and make sure that they feel, on track. So I shared a wee bit about my own life sort of philosophy. And I shared something that I suppose is a bit embarrassing, Steve, but the truth is, even from when I was like 20 years old, probably, give or take, I had this metaphor in my head. And it was that every time I made a life decision, every time I took a course or a job or, chose a career option, whatever it was, that actually in my head I had this idea that I was in a hallway. And that there were a number of doors in it, a lot of doors when I was 20, like 50 doors, 100 doors, and I would pick one. And this metaphor I had in my head was that I would go through the door and suddenly there would be 5 doors, not 100. And my metaphor for my life was every time I made a choice, it's like if you study science, suddenly you don't have philosophy open to you anymore, you don't have psychology, sociology, I couldn't be a lawyer. Now, strictly speaking, that's not true, but that's the metaphor I had in my head, was these hallways that every time you walk through a doorway gave you another hallway with fewer doors. Does that make any sense as a metaphor? Can you
sure, yeah,
that?
Yeah.
The choices in life, you start as a child with infinite choices, and by the time you get to an adult, you've made your choices and you're into, a sort of narrower doorway. I have accepted this unquestioningly. I don't know if I've ever discussed it with anyone. Never written it anywhere. It's just in my head. That is what I have as my model for life. And I said that quite confidently. And I had this bizarre moment. I use superlatives too much, Steve. So it means when I really need one, I'm stuck. And I sat back in my seat smugly, with a coffee with this wonderful colleague, and I was looked at straight in the eye. And what was said was, really? I've always seen it as the opposite. Absolutely the opposite. And I went to say, yeah, how can that be? And then I thought, okay. And I imagined turning this in its head, that every time I opened the door, because I'd made a decision, the decision could actually open, 100 doorways now instead of the 5 I thought, because actually the decisions I'd made opened out new things for me. And I actually went over a period of about, half an hour, after, I focused on my coaching and my work for this person, but afterwards, driving home, I thought, I can imagine, actually, after my 5 minutes of resistance to this model, that could be true. That in a crude way, my model was right, but in other ways, it could be wrong, that this could be a better model. And my point in this blog, which I entitled When One Door Closes, was just simply this. what are the metaphors that all of us carry in our head in terms of our learning? Because, you know, we think in metaphors. I know to various degrees there's a debate about, you know, that. But to some degree, at least, we think in metaphor. And I have a metaphor there, which I'm 48 years old. You know, I've carried in my head for something like 28 years or more. Without putting out on a plate for people to talk about or grab or capture or more, you know, more importantly, challenge. And it has guided my mental state, my inner well-being, my sense of what's possible and what's not. So what, Steve, do you carry in your head that's a metaphor for your life that you haven't shared? It is, of course, a rhetorical question, but that was the point in my post, you know.
Yeah,
please,
yeah.
Can you all think about this a little bit? Because if you know, lifelong learning is about anything, it's surely about also checking the metaphors that underpin your approach to that learning.
Absolutely, yeah.
There we go. There's not much to be said about that, really, is there?
No.
It's a very personal metaphor.
Let's have your metaphors then, folks.
Briefly, I think it is worth, no matter how long the cast is running, mentioning Chris Woodhead died during that month.
Yeah, you had a quote, didn't you, on...
Well, it was a quote that I thought was wonderful, because I always like things that challenge us, you know, in the spirit of what I've just said. Chris Woodhead, object of hate. It's not an unreasonable thing to say, is it? You know, despite the crocodile tears that we're all capable of, I don't mean literally, but at least the crocodile words of sympathy that we can all conjure up, you know, the teaching profession has not lost a lot of love over Chris Woodhead.
Yeah.
Our own, you know, very good friend John Macbeth, when he's been on our cast, has never spoken all that warmly about Woodhead's influence on the profession. So I found this quote on the day that he died, and I think we can extend human sympathy to him. He had a hard end. Was it motor neuron disease or
something like that? Yeah.
It was certainly a kind of a wasting degenerative disease. You know, it was about I know what it is, but I just can't remember. But it was a nervous degeneration disease. He also had something else simultaneously, you know, like he had some other condition, so he was a poor soul at the end. But here's a quote from after he was, you know, in the mainstream. Teachers are no longer in a profession. State school staff are expected to be puppets for ministers' latest agendas, even if they're nonsense. I don't understand. Why has there not been widespread rebellion, riots in teacher training institutions, expressions of disgust in staff rooms? That was Chris Woodhead.
Yeah.
You know, you put people in a box, you think this guy just wanted people to comply.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do. That's what's expected. But well, this guy, somewhere in him, had this moment of, you know...
I thought it was rather ironic, really.
Yeah, I thought it was ironic too. Yeah, yeah, of course. That's my point.
He was...
Yes. Hugely ironic. This is the guy who was a control, you know, agent, you know, who's saying, why were they not riot? Well, why? But actually, they did riot a little bit. They didn't riot, literally. They didn't smash chairs.
No.
But, you know, in terms of a kind of a national movement, he was so aboard that it was like a soft riot against him.
Yeah.
But anyway, there you go. So the man was perfectly capable, without irony, I have to say, as all chief inspectors of any type seem to be after their chief inspection career is over, of being philosophical about the whole business of, you know, leading schools in a way that seldom acknowledges their own role in that.
Yeah.
And I would include in that Graham Donaldson, who once guested in this programme, who was a Scottish, you know, chief inspector, who I really like as a speaker and a commentator. But I think it always has to acknowledge that he speaks about the dangers of hard inspection almost, you know, without irony, when he himself was, you know, in charge of a very hard Scottish inspection regime.
Yeah.
So, but, you know... Anyway, I just want to say, you know, my human sympathy is, it's like the Thatcher thing. I don't like much of what Thatcher did, because I'm a Scottish left-wing family boy, you know. But I don't think she set out wanting to kill and hurt people. I think she probably thought that that's what was needed. And in some ways, history has recorded that some of the stuff that she did that seemed abhorrent then may well have been needed.
Mm.
Woodhead, I find it harder to make that analysis, but it's quite recent. But... I'm sure he didn't believe he was hurting teachers. He probably thought he was doing good.
Mm.
So, I won't say I'm sorry he's not chief inspector anymore, but I will say I'm sorry he had a sad ending to his life.
Mm. Yep.
So the best he can do by way of human sympathy there, Steve.
Yeah, no, no, well...
He's not an easy man, you know, in terms
no,
of...
No, no, I mean, he did
what,
try...
And, what he did with us, he did damage.
He did try and... He tried to rewrite the report, the HMI, the Austin Inspection of Birmingham, where Tim Brickhouse was there.
Oh,
he tried to rewrite it. He did. Well, he did. He actually rewrote it to try and make it look bad on Birmingham. But he was definitely capable of evil political machinations. So,
I don't think any. I think the undercurrent to what I'm saying here is that we all accept that. No one thinks this was a good.
Yeah,
this
no,
was
no.
A good
I mean,
force.
I mean,
was,
I agree.
He was, a,
I
he was
agree.
A bad piece of work in terms of his.
But I
influence.
Agree. You don't want to wish the kind of painful ends on people, do you?
Yeah.
But I think it. I mean, it's interesting because it just comes back to my point earlier about, you know, there are people who believe they're doing good, like we believe we're doing good. But whatever.
I know, I was just thinking that, you know, the new generation of Woodheads listen to this frothing at the mouth.
Yeah,
you know,
but I mean,
I hope one day history will try and judge kindly these bastards Boyle and Rogers. You know, they thought they were doing good, but they were actually a corrosive influence in education and learning.
But exactly. So how do you? I mean, this is one of the paradoxes of liberalism. How do you reconcile? You know, everyone. You know, liberalism said, "Yeah, you're entitled to your own views, but how do you reconcile those views for the greater good?"
Well, can I be clear here? I'm not apologising for them, and I don't think you can reconcile it. I don't think any modern narrative of what happened in schools would say, unless you're extremely right wing, that what he did was helpful.
No,
however,
but the problem is, you see, we could argue about that at the time, but you're only going to kind of have those arguments looking back, aren't you? That's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So all I thought was interesting, you know, in the wake of a sad death, as any human's is, that, and actually when you start reading Wikipedia, you know, you start to realise that he became an activist for human euthanasia latterly, which must say something about his own fears about himself. You know, I wouldn't make the direct link, but, you know, why did he suddenly become an activist in his latter years? Well, he realised he might be in for a bad end, you know, the poor soul. And no matter how, you know, how malign his influence may have been, you know, none of us wish that on him. But interesting to see a quote like that come out. You know, he made that quote at some level in him. Maybe if you try really hard for just 5 minutes to be charitable, was he maybe a misaligned, a misdirected rebel? You know, was he a guy who was an iconoclast or a rebel who just didn't ever quite find his place to let that out?
No, I think that's a good point, Matthew. I think there's certainly something of the iconoclast in him, you know. And certainly, you know, we would all say, yeah, actually, a lot of ministers' latest agendas are nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's never anyone who's so bad or out there that you can't find something in what they did or said. So, anyway, there we go.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really funny when you put it up.
Well, the man has gone and, you know, I guess... It would be just slightly bizarre not to note or mark it. He's been a huge influence in education.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I suppose one final thing, which I can probably list in 1 minute, personal challenges, my last post of that month.
Yep.
Was kind of a it was a homily, really, actually, to a hero of mine. I haven't read this for a month and a half myself, having written it, but it was about the experience I had. I don't remember when. 2007, it says. During 2007, I was getting very keen in photography. I'd only been a few months into it, and I read something on Amateur Photographer magazine, a news item saying that this New York photographer who I'd never heard of was doing a 365 project. Now, these days, everyone's doing 365 projects, but it was relatively new at the time, and it was a portrait every day, and I kind of thought about that for a minute or two. I thought, no. How do you do it? How do you take someone's picture every day? You know, Christmas Day, you know, your birthday, you know. How do you constantly say to people, I'm sorry, I'm busy today, I'm taking someone's portrait, you know? And I got interested. I found the website, and I think from memory it was like, you know, February or something like that when I actually read this news. And of course, I then had to look back over the January, you know, to February. But that's 45 portraits immediately on the website. I'm thinking, jings, this is a lot of work, you know? I loved them. There was a... there was a style to them. There was something very real about the way he took pictures, a playfulness, but also something about capturing a, you know, an on the day essence of people, you know, and placing them in a beautiful, exciting setting that clearly was not managed. You know, it was clearly about places that they were comfortable rather than, you know, a studio that he had chosen. And I loved it, absolutely loved it, and it was a drug-like obsession, as I've written in the blog. And I followed it all year. And when he sometimes had a few days that he was offline and couldn't post, oh, I was like a heroin addict looking for my fix, you know. I just loved it. I can't tell you, I didn't know anything about this guy. And at first, you know, 3 or 4 months in, I didn't know any of the people. But you see these pictures and you think, oh, I'd like to know this person. I want to know more about them. You know, who is he? What does he do? You know, what's she about in this picture? Is she into sport? Is she, you know, it's just dead interesting. Sometime around about October or something like that, suddenly a guy who you and I would have been delighted by appeared, and I thought, I cannot believe what I'm seeing. It was James Burke suddenly appeared in it as his subject. Right. You know, Connections, do you remember that?
No.
James Burke, Connections, Tomorrow's World presenter.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Connections?
Yeah, you're right.
Suddenly photographed James Burke. Now, he photographed lots of celebrities who I didn't really know, but then James Burke appeared. I thought, oh my God, you know. And it turns out that this photographer that I know nothing about but really like was brought up watching James Burke's Connections in America, you know. And, you know, although he's not a scientist himself, he's had a passion for that kind of knowledge of the universe stuff, you know. And to have sought out James Burke in London and photographed him in a misty day in London Bridge, you know, it's just like, ah, you know, wonderful. Anyway, so it got me to thinking, well, what could I do? And I did my own very humble, you know, while working full time, 100 Portraits project.
Yeah.
Which I've never really written about on our blog, you know, but I thought it was interesting, you know, which was about me taking a person I knew, my sister-in-law's sister, both people I'm very, very fond of indeed. And my sister-in-law's sister got talking to me about photography, so she became my first subject. But I started a chain. The 100 people had to be people I didn't know who chose each other in a chain.
Right, yeah,
so
yeah.
So within the year I did it, I don't remember when it was, 2008 probably or something like that, thereabouts. It was a fabulous year. I learned more about photography that year than I've learned since, because each time someone said, no, I want to meet you at 11 a.m, it's got to be in that place, indoors, outdoors, basement, whatever. I never specified. I just simply said to them, you tell me what works for you, where will you be happy being photographed? And often you would turn up, and in terms of light and photography, it could be an abysmal place. So my first 10 subjects probably were a bit random, you know, and then I had to very quickly learn, how do you control that light, you know, so that as a photographer, you know, you can cope with these different situations. It was wonderful. And the point of my post, I'm not going to go through any of the rest of it, because there was a few other examples. But De Bono, you know, always talks about this idea that, you know, creativity comes from provocation. That, you know, creativity is not about doing what you already know how to do in the way you know how to do it. It's about being constrained in some way, creatively, positively, sometimes negatively, that, oh my goodness, you know, suppose, for example, you didn't have the ability to do that way, what would you do? And actually, that was the point of the personal challenges post for me, that some of your most creative work comes from times that you've set yourself a personal challenge, whether it's to write a book, for you to write your PhD. You know, you didn't have infinite freedom then. Suddenly you'd set constraints. You had to meet a time scale, certain targets and outline principles, outcomes that you'd set for yourself. And I'll bet that was deeply uncomfortable at times, hugely, you know, and yet it probably produced creativity, when you had to match ideas and concepts that are out there to what you'd said you would achieve. And for me, you know, like years and years ago, I recorded a few CDs for personal use when I used to, you know, sing and play in pubs and things. And that was a constraint. I'm going to record a CD. I now have, you know, 74 minutes that I've got to fill with music. You know, what's my theme? What's my point? You know, these projects make you creative. And actually, I guess what I'm really getting at is, if you want to be more creative, yes, produce a few. Yeah, maybe in schools as well. Maybe if you want young people to be more creative, don't just have them drift from subject to bloody subject to, you know. Maybe instead get them to stop and take bigger chunks of their time and say, what's your project going to be? What are you going to learn to do that's a big piece of work, a big project, a big creative endeavour? And you know, what constraints will you put in yourself to make sure that you have to think hard differently and, you know, produce something different? Mm. So there we go. That was that post.
No. Excellent, yeah. No.
So that's us actually just about to get into the month of July. We don't have time now for it, do we?
No.
Bundle July in with whatever comes out of August.
Yeah. Yep.
And we'll do a review of that then, because I believe you've got the only two posts in July. We pretty much took time out, didn't we?
Yes, we did, yeah. Yeah, what a month.
What a month indeed. Steve, that's been a long cast for us. Yeah, but it's been a while since we have
really,
talked.
Yeah, and it's gone really quickly.
Yeah,
really enjoyed
really,
that chat.
Yeah, has. Wonderful to talk with you again.
And you, Matthew. Yeah, a lot of stuff coming out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of thoughts. And I'll go and dust off some of the draft notes I've put together for August blogs. And as ever, you know, anyone else who wishes to contribute or add anything, you know, each and every dog has always been an open project, although we're driving at the moment. Anyone who wants to reblog or originally blog on it, feel free. You're always welcome.
Please. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I look forward to our next encounter.
Martha Nussbaum, here we come.
Yep.
Steve, thank you, sir.
And thank you.